I'm going to put it back to the beginning. Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lisa Hawkins, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here at the U, locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is A National Tour Exposing a Silent Social Tragedy. Today's guest is Craig Juntinen. He is the founder and president of Both Ends Burning Campaign, a child welfare advocate and a passionate believer in international adoption. Juntinen is the author of Both Ends Burning, My Story of Adopting Three Children from Haiti, and the executive producer of the acclaimed documentary Stuck. Craig leads the campaign's effort to build a social movement to enact real and lasting change for the world's orphaned and abandoned children. In his early life, Craig was involved heavily in athletics, playing quarterback for a total of 14 seasons. He finished his athletic career as a quarterback in the Canadian Football League. He was elected into the State of Idaho Athletic Hall of Fame and the University of Idaho Hall of Fame. His experience as a leader on the football field led to his developing into an entrepreneur. He built and sold a company with a very successful track record and temporarily retired. His experience as a quarterback and as an entrepreneur blended together to form philanthropic passions. He has been involved in many charitable giving efforts, and until recently, his most notable achievement was launching the Chances for Children Foundation, which supports villages in Haiti and has placed more than 100 children in adoptive families in the last 3 years. He and his wife, Kathy, live in Scottsdale, Arizona, with their three children, Amalek, Espy, and Quinn. Please join me in welcoming Craig Juntinen.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Walking around this campus, you guys are really lucky and privileged to be in a place that offers, or it looks like at least it offers you so very much. So congratulations to you. It made a very, very favorable impression on me. And we are traveling around this beautiful country of ours in a tour bus, 80 days, 62 cities, 18,000 miles, to make children living outside of parental care a relevant social issue. We are screening a film, and the purpose of showing this film is to create an educational platform, generate awareness about a silent social tragedy, hopefully form the social and political will to deal with this issue. So I am the executive producer of the film Stuck, which is now making its way across the country. Tonight we're showing at the Tower Theater. It's city number 29 on our tour. The first 28 cities have been a remarkable and energizing experience that have become much more than just a screening of a film. It's really become more of an event, and the town hall discussion that follows the film has really been the most meaningful part of our experience in the city. So just so you know, when executive producer is code for shameless promoter, so keep in line with that. I'm going to show you the trailer of the film, and then I'm going to tell you the story and the purpose of the film, and then how this might inspire you to follow down your own path to promote social change for the good. Here's the
We were toasting, and he said, to family. I was like, okay, I have to go somewhere and cry right now. It's too much.
The
current international adoption process takes nearly 3 years and costs around $28,000.
And the most frustrating part is that all of these kids have families. All of these kids have homes in the U.S., and they have for years.
I've applied like three different times for the same adoption.
It's been 3.5 years. No one has come for him. We are his only hope.
In the past 5 years, the number of children adopted into the U.S. has plummeted by 50%.
Millions of children are denied the opportunity to thrive.
My son has virtually no teeth on the top. They've all decayed because they're not getting proper nutrition.
The first time we entered an institution, we were speechless. Raising children almost the way you'd raise cattle.
The world has stopped paying attention, and it's failing.
We thought we were going to be one of those families stuck forever. And then in 2 or 3 days, our situation changed completely.
We made the request to the State Department to get those 3,000 children out of Haiti.
All the children in the middle of an adoption process were able to come home.
We saw Erickson being carried out, and we just ran.
We don't need earthquakes or tsunamis. There are millions of children in need, thousands dying every day. Why don't we do something about it?
We want each of these senators to know if we shut down international adoptions, what we are saying to the children is that they don't matter.
The right to a family is a basic human right, and our policies have to start recognizing that.
I love you, Mom.
I love you, too.
We were toasting, and he said to family, I was like, okay, I have to go somewhere and cry right now. It was too much.
Well, I hope that was intriguing, anyways, and maybe that will inspire you to come out to the Tower Theater tonight at 7 o'clock. How this came about, I'm not a filmmaker. In fact, in 2005, the furthest thing from my awareness was anything that had to do with adoption, anything that had to do with child welfare, and how this film and the movement that we're trying to create came about is a very long story. But I want to share it with you. I'll try to make it as brief and as concise as possible. But I think it is an important story because it does show a trajectory and an arc of how change can be produced. So, 2006, I happened to play golf with an acquaintance. You see, I was a retired businessman, retired in 1998. And my goal was to really just ride off into the sunset, play golf, ski, and enjoy the life that I thought I deserved after selling my business in 1995. So we were living in Vail, Colorado. We were traveling the world and golfing, and that was really great for the first couple of years. But ultimately, this whole idea that there has to be more to life than golfing and skiing every day abruptly introduced itself. And as I was basically questioning the honest measure of my worth, what am I going to really do with the rest of my life, I ended up playing golf with an acquaintance. And it was 2006, and we were both 51 years of age. And as we were getting acquainted, walking up the first fairway, he had told me he and his wife had adopted 2 children from Haiti. It was the second-generation parenting experience for them, which I found very, very interesting. They had raised 3 boys that were now up in their 20s, and at 51, they decided to have another round of parenting and bringing these 2 beautiful children from Haiti into their family. I was intrigued with Haiti and this whole idea of adoption, which was stunning to my wife because I was a desk-pounding, I'm never going to be a dad guy. Children was not part of, being a father was not part of the plan. But anyways, this intrigue, this curiosity from this one conversation inspired me to go to Haiti, which I did. I went to Haiti a few months later, found an orphanage that was out of money, fell in love with 3 beautiful children. At 51 years of age, I became a father. And now in the world of international adoption. So we took over an orphanage. We founded a foundation called Chances for Children, which I am proud to say still thrives and exists in Haiti, and is making a meaningful contribution every day to countless lives. But we really thought that was going to be it. We really thought, okay, we're going to run this orphanage, raise our 3 children, who at the time were 5, 4, and 9 months old, and that would represent a much more significant lifestyle and contribution than just going off and playing golf every day. But then, my golf buddies were so astounded that I had done this. We had taken this abrupt detour. They said, you, a dad, 3 kids? And an orphanage? Really? You? You got to write a book about it. So I did. In the middle of the night when my kids first came home, I wrote a book. It's a lighthearted personal anecdote. It's called Both Ends Burning, which is a phrase my mother used to use when she was flabbergasted or overwhelmed. And at 51, as a rookie parent to a 5, 4, and 9-month-old, and two of them not speaking English, there were times when both ends were burning. I was overwhelmed, but it was still enchanting, and it was an awakening for all five of us, the three children, my wife, and myself. And it was so meaningful for me, writing the book was really easy. And I wrote the book to inspire others to consider the possibility of adopting, for if I could be doing it and enjoying it, here I am, this desk pounding, I'm never going to be a dad guy, but if I could be enjoying this, anybody could. So, and the book actually served its purpose. People would read the book, and by the way, the book will never be confused as a literary masterpiece, but it worked. People read the book, said, you know what, we hadn't thought about it, but we might want to adopt too now. And then the key early learning was they couldn't. They were too young. They were too old. There were all these barriers and restrictions that were preventing good people with a sincere interest in adopting a child who today was condemned to grow up in an orphanage away. And I said, this can't be right. I must be misunderstanding this because this just defies common sense. So it inspired me to go out and learn more. And originally I was just curious because of this lack of sensibility, this lack of common sense. And ultimately, the more I learned, I went from curious to concerned. And then ultimately I became outraged. I went everywhere. I went to the I went to UNICEF. I went to the UN. I went to the State Department. I went to members of Congress. We did two studies. We did the first field study in 13 years on international adoption and its effects and its impressions on the U.S. population. And there was a lot of key learnings, but the most prevalent learning was that there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation about international adoption. And meanwhile, what I kept seeing every day at home were our three kids who were now thriving. They were having breakthroughs. And what I learned is that kids are kids, whether they're born in Houston or Haiti. And then what I also saw as I went back and forth to the original Chances for Children orphanage and saw these children in other orphanages and in our orphanage and in on the streets is that when you go into these environments, what you see is this enormous eclipse of human potential. So I was living this knife edge every day. Our kids were having friends and Little League, and they were having a childhood. And their potential was blossoming. And then I'd go back to Haiti, and I'd see children who were just rotting away. And their lifestyle and their childhood was so compromised, it was having a profound impact on who they were becoming as individuals. So I just thought this was fundamentally wrong. And so I went to a prominent U.S. senator in 2009. And I asked this prominent senator for help because I had discovered something that was socially and fundamentally flawed and wrong, and it was having a tragic impact on the lives of countless and maybe even millions of children. And I thought action was not only required, it was necessary. He turned me down. My plea for help fell on deaf ears because he basically said the numbers of adoption aren't big enough for me to warrant this as a priority. And I said, well, that's the point. The numbers aren't big enough, but they could be a lot bigger if we could make things easier. See, what we discovered was the bad guy in this scenario was that you had all of these children, you had all of these families who wanted to adopt those very children, but they couldn't. And the reason they couldn't was because the process was dysfunctional and broken. So we had a process problem in this inefficient, this dysfunctional system was actually damaging and destroying children's lives. And processes are easily fixed if you have the will and the mind share and the resources to apply to solve those issues. So we, based on getting turned away from that senator's office, that this could not, at least in his mind, these children's lives were not a priority. And in essence, what he was basically saying is we have things that are more important, I really felt that was where I became outraged. Because I saw these kids, and I basically learned as I traveled back and forth to Haiti and to a lot of other countries, is that every child has this human potential and this inner magic, and that as us as responsible citizens and responsible adults, we should be able to be doing a better job for these kids. So I then happened to meet on the phone or some early conversations with two real pioneers of social movements. Because I started to study, how do you solve things? How do you create social transformation? And if you look at in historically or historic terms, we've changed our mind about women's rights, changed our mind about civil rights, we changed our mind about slavery. We change our minds all the time. And what happens is when new information collides with common sense, change occurs. Especially when new information is based in scientific evidence, and that scientific evidence collides with common sense, then change occurs. You guys will get a kick out of this because you're all relatively young, but I'm an ex-football player. I'm going to kind of age myself here, but in 1966, the common prevailing thinking was it was wrong to give an athlete, even a 12-year-old athlete, water before or during athletic competition. They thought it was bad for you. Can you believe it? The term hydration didn't exist. Today, if your 12-year-old son was at the heat of practice in full football equipment in August and had a two-hour practice without a water break, somebody would get sued or somebody would go to jail. But in 1966, they thought it was wrong for you. They thought they were protecting us by not giving us water. Hydration was not part of our vernacular. So where was the tipping point? The tipping point in this sense was really these scientists out of University of Florida who created a concoction called Gatorade. Gatorade started very small, and once it started to emerge into a variety of university campuses for their athletic teams, studies were done. And those studies validated the exact opposite of what we thought we knew to be true. We changed our minds because science collided with common sense. And today, hydration is a big part of our vernacular. Along this way, after I was turned down by the member of Congress, and I was also, looking at all of these issues and all of the roadblocks and how these children's lives hadn't been elevated as a priority to any of us was just shocking to me. So I met two brave women. One's named Candy Leitner, and one is named Nancy Brinker. I just talked to them on the phone. Didn't meet them in person, but talked to them on the phone. But Candy started Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Nancy started Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Awareness. These were just two women who were responding and reacting to something that was wrong. They basically had said, personally, enough is enough, and they decided to do something about it. Candy started Mothers Against Drunk Driving as a pure grassroots movement, and today, 32 years later, she changed the way we think and the way we behave. The term designated driver didn't exist in 1985, but it's part of our culture today. Our awareness shifted, and common sense prevailed. Nancy made a commitment to her dying sister, who was dying of breast cancer, that she wouldn't die in vain. One voice led to another voice and another voice, and the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation today raises around $50 million a year for research. Breast cancer deaths are down. Awareness is skyrocketing. And today the NFL's wearing pink shoes. It's a remarkable achievement because you have to understand where it came from. It came from one individual, just like you and you and you and you. One person who had the courage and the wherewithal to say, this is wrong and I'm going to try to change it. Frequently, we tend to believe that something is wrong, but we can't fix it because the problem is too big. And one person can't really change things. But that's not true. History tells us just the opposite. One person who's willing to stand tall can form a movement, and movements are what produce social transformation. When you think about it, it has to be a movement that's going to create social transformation because political ecosystems, governments, and politicians, they don't do things proactively. They react. But they don't react to the one voice. They react to the mass voice. And so when the people are willing to lead, the leaders will follow. And that is how this country has grown, That's how this country got better. And that's exactly the principles that I am applying as we go across this country to form our social movement to make children living outside of parental care a relevant social issue. There's a great line that says, every poet is a thief. Nothing we are doing to create our social movement is new or inventive, with the exception of the fact that we have tied the old-fashioned bus tour to the release of a documentary film. But other than that, this is a tried and true formula where we're out trying to expose an issue to put us in a position to promote solutions. So our challenge was, we have a silent social tragedy, and how are we going to distribute information so that this new information and this awareness can ultimately produce change, the outcome being, in this case, more children having a family. So many people had said to me, the way you do it in this day and age is you make a film. I said, yeah, I've seen that. I saw what Waiting for Superman did about public education. I saw what The Cove did for dolphin slaying. Did you see The Cove about dolphin slaying in Japan? Fabulous film. You guys should watch The Cove. They got a sequel coming out soon, by the way. We've gotten to know those people. They're fabulous filmmakers. You know, Inconvenient Truth. Think about that. Think about the stir that Inconvenient Truth created. You know, everybody arguing about, was the science right? Was it wrong? Did they made it up? Did they distort the facts? Hey, but guess what? We were now talking about the issue. And the one side and the other side, while we were arguing, that debate influenced many of us to go buy new light bulbs at Home Depot. Our awareness changed, and our behavior was altered. So what we're trying to do is make children outside of parental care a relevant social issue with the course of the film. And it was a real leap of faith for me because I was not a filmmaker. First, I was never an author. I'm really just a retired businessman who 6-7 years ago had no awareness of this issue. And this was really influenced, very similar to how Candy was influenced, how Nancy was influenced, and how other circumstances have been influenced. One circumstance, one conversation on a golf course with an acquaintance in 2006 about adopting two children from a country I knew nothing about, got me thinking, and here I am today speaking to you, my tour bus down the street, and I was showing the film in 62 cities to create the sense of awareness. So the film took us 2 years and 2 months to create. We are very, very lucky that this film has had already an impact in the sense that we are trying to gather 1 million signatures as we go all the way around the country. We started in Washington, D.C., and we are going to basically make a very jagged circle and back in Washington, D.C. on May 17th for the Step Forward for Orphans March, where we will deliver our petition that we would love all of you to sign that says making children outside of parental care should be a priority, and we need to put the resources and manpower in place to reinvent the current system that is failing children. So we're going to deliver a petition to try to stimulate action that will produce outcome, tried and true formula. So now the film really has had a really interesting course and early on in its life has had some remarkable achievement, and I am the executive producer, which is code for shameless promoter, and I am bragging a little bit about the film. But we were able to show this film in the Congressional Theater, which does take an act of Congress. We were able to win an award at a film festival, which is also a very unique circumstance. And we were able to align with a famous Hollywood iconic force to be our distribution partner. And film does work. My experience now in the first 29 of the 62 cities is it does allow a wide audience. Our average audience is somewhere between 150 and 200 people each night to come together and have this meaningful collision of new information, common sense, and conversation. And so after we show the film, we've been engaging in these really great town hall meetings where people are asking questions, and most people's reaction to the film is, I had no idea, and then how can I help? So where we are with it today is the film has stimulated enough awareness is that there already is a new piece of legislation that's currently being drafted that will be introduced sometime in the near future that we hope will be able to coincide with our Step Forward for Orphans March. And we will be able to get that legislation onto the floor and get it passed to be a critical first step to produce long and lasting change for children living outside of parental care. Many of you probably don't know about the complexities of adoption, the complexities of international adoption, or how, you know, how socially governments tend to react and deal with problems. But over the last 6.5, almost 7 years, it's been a great awakening for me. And the message that I could give you as university students is that you can make a difference. People do matter. In fact, history tells us that's how it all started. When I had the luxury of traveling the first 15 cities of the tour with our three children. Our children came home in 2006 from Haiti. They were 5, 4, and 9 months old. They are my pride and joy. Being a parent to them is the best experience of my life, and I had the privilege to take them out on the road. And we had this huge press conference in D.C. right before we took off. We had three members of Congress endorse the film and the tour, which was really also something that was very unique and a real privilege for me to be part of. But me and the kids flew out to D.C. the night before. We landed about 7 o'clock, and I said, come on, guys, we have somewhere to go. So we went and we threw our bags in the room, and we headed straight over to the Lincoln Memorial. And it was, you know, the end of February, and it was a really cold night. There was not a cloud in the sky, and the moon was up, and it was just beautiful. And there was nobody there. I've been to the Lincoln Memorial many, many times, but it's usually packed. There was just nobody there, and the lights beaming up from it. And I walked those steps with my three kids, staring straight at that iconic symbol of decency and making things right. It was just so powerful. I mean, I really loved it. And then we walked around it, and we just all took it in as a family. Then we walked from there straight over to the Martin Luther King Memorial. And it was just brilliant. We took turns getting our pictures taken by all of those great quotes of his, and we were really reminded what a brave and courageous group of people that was to really fight back for something that was wrong. And then I just took the kids to dinner. And I said, kids, guys, you know, there was a reason I took you to those two places. I just wasn't killing time working up an appetite. I took you to those two places because I wanted to show you that things that are wrong can be made right. And they're made right when a large group of people come together in unison, stomp their feet, and say, enough is enough. I'm inspired with our work to advocate for children who are living outside of parental care because historically it says there's a track record that says we have a chance to succeed. And I hope that inspires you that in your lifetime, maybe you'll come across something that is wrong. And maybe if one of you in this audience remembers what I have said today, and it just sticks with you maybe 5 or 10 years from now. And when that moment comes along, that moment when you come upon something that's really wrong, you're going to have a choice. The choice is you're going to either have to look at a way to rationalize and accept that wrong, or you're going to have to stand tall and fight it. And what I tell the audience is, you know, at the end of our film, because most of this is new information. Most people don't really know very much about this issue at all. So what I usually tell our audience is at the end, after I ask for their help to join our movement, I always say from this point forward, you may choose to turn your back on these kids. But from this point forward, you can never say you don't know. Does anybody have any questions, thoughts? Oh, here's my moderator.
I'll just grab the microphone.
Okay, great.
Make sure to speak really directly into the mic, okay?
Hi, I was just wondering about kids in the U.S., inside the U.S., and adoptions for them.
Great. We've heard that question. That's a great question. Thank you very much. Every town hall discussion we've had, we've heard that question paraphrased, which is, hey, wait a minute, what about our kids? And my response to you is the same response I give every night, which is I believe our sense of responsibility for children should not be contained or confined by borders. They're all our kids. Now, U.S. adoption is also declining. Domestic adoption has had a softer landing than international adoption. The U.S. has gone from about 24 at its peak to now it's about 18,000. International adoption peaked at about 22,000, and it's fallen eight straight years, to now about 8,000. Foster care programs are improving, but still represent, there's still opportunity for improvement. The Joe Jones study indicates that at any given time in this country, there are around 900,000 families that would like to adopt. So if you use those numbers, 50,000 foster care approximately, 18,000 domestic approximately last year, 8,000 international, 93 or 92% of that population that want to adopt are not adopting. And in most cases, the reason they are not adopting is the system is so burdensome, so complex, and so daunting, they decide to walk away from it, even though they'd love to add a child or children to their family. So our hope is, by the way, our conversation, and on our bus, it says, and on our poster, it says, every child deserves a family. This is a human rights issue. Every child does deserve a family, whether they're born in the United States, whether they're born in Haiti, wherever they're born. And what we're hoping is that the conversation starts with family matters, and the most significant thing to a child is a family. Then we're hoping that through our film, which does expose this really broken system in international adoption and how that system is preventing children from joining a family, but we just hope it creates a broader conversation. And the outcome is this comprehensive, broad-based set of solutions for all kinds of methodologies for a child to join a family. We're hoping family reunification programs get energized. How about family preservation programs get energized? How about domestic, foster? You know, all of the programs to get a child into a family should be looked at as a comprehensive set or a comprehensive program that serve the welfare of children. So, but they're all, in my mind, they're all kids are kids. Yes, sir.
My name is Jefferson. I'm a gender studies major here at the university. And my question is, right now it feels like a really relevant conversation is with like the hearings of the Supreme Court is adoption by same-sex couples. So I'm curious, regarding adoption by same-sex couples, are there additional challenges that are facing them for international adoption, and is that being addressed in the legislation that you're introducing?
Well, ultimately that's going to be a slow arc, and that's going to be included in this conversation is what is the definition of a family? All right, for our purposes right now, we're just trying to, we are not advocating for any one real piece of legislation, nor one solution. What we're trying to create is a broad-based global conversation that kids deserve a family, and how we look at that, how we manage that in the years ahead is really going to be distilled down. My guess is that over time, pathways for children into a family are going to expand, not become more and more narrow. Yes.
My name is Patricio Panuncio. I'm a political science and sociology major. I'm just curious as to what were some of the resources that you would say contributed most to the success of your movement?
I had a really good team of people. And, you know, my background, great question. My background, I had the privilege to grow up as a football player. And I really saw how relevant team, talent, camaraderie, common mindset, all of those play into creating success. I applied all of that into my business where it really came down to creating great teams. That was actually one of the things my company did was we tried to create and facilitate great teamwork and teams within companies. So the difference maker for a film project, I believe, is the teamwork and the personnel. And we were really lucky to have such a wonderful group of artists and craftspeople who really came together dedicated to create a loud and provocative voice for children today who are being ignored. One of the things I will clear up as we go out on the road and I go from city to city on the bus, and we're getting, thankfully, a lot of media attention, which is great. People often refer to this as Craig's film. Well, I'm the executive producer. The buck does stop here. It's not Craig's film. I mean, 45 people are there, give or take, were involved in this project, and they should all be applauded and congratulated. But we had a great group of artists, and it all came together. And by the way, the finished product, I think, really works. But along the way, we had our challenges, we had our dead ends, and we had our roadblocks. And the filmmaking process is a very organic thing, especially when you're making a documentary, because there is no script, and you have to find your way. And originally what we had was a news piece. This is probably the second answer to your question. And what we realized was that audiences ultimately connect with storyline and character much more so than content. And I really wanted to find a way how we weave these stories in so that the audience would be compelled to stay for the whole 90 minutes or 82 minutes. And so ultimately what we were able to produce, I think, is just a wonderful and touching love story. And it shows that how the power of love really can have such a profound influence in how powerful love is. So it's on the bus it also says it's more than a documentary, it's a love story. Yes.
Hi, my name is Mara Dern. I just wanted to ask you if there was ever a point in your experience where you wanted to, where you were about to accept, like, nothing was going to work, that you were going to turn your back on it, and how you overcame that?
Okay. The question was, how many times did I feel like quitting? Plenty. And, any challenge like this is hard, especially when you're in new territory. When you're, having made a film, never made a film, and this is a daunting task. What kept me going was two things. One, our kids at home, and seeing how they were thriving and watching their potential just blossom. And then all of these children we had left behind. We'd go into these orphanages. We probably filmed in around 30 orphanages in total. And it was just so devastating to see the consequences of this compromised lifestyle these children were living. And I never forgot that. I never will forget that. And that's what kept me going when personally I felt I'm tired, I'm discouraged, we aren't going to make it. So the personal instinct to quit started to emerge, and then the anchors for me were my kids growing and thriving and the kids we left behind. You're a university student, so I'm going to teach you something right now. One of the things we learned as we went into these orphanages was the universal language of an orphan. And this happened in every country and in every orphanage. We would walk in, and now you got to understand, there was probably 5, 6, 7 of us. We had gear and stuff. We'd leave everything outside, and we'd start to kind of work our way in. And we didn't want to be intruding or barging in. We wanted to be, as graceful and as respectful as we possibly could be. But at the minute we would walk into these orphanages, kids would look up at us. They'd come running to the door. Pick me up. Pick me up for 1 minute. Hold me. Make me feel special. Make me feel like I matter. It's not that the caregivers don't care. They do care. But there's 4 caregivers and 80 kids. And these caregivers are just going from crisis to crisis to crisis. And by the end of the day, they're so washed out that they just want to go home. And these kids just, there's such an absence of love. And they really, the fact that they are denied a childhood, and they're denied a future. Because what happens to these children who don't experience love, who don't have a childhood, they ultimately age out of the system. We show this in our film, show a child who does age out. And what happens is they go out onto the streets, ill-prepared, to live a productive life. I mean, when you think about it, they would have a hard time bonding with another human being, can't read, can't write, so they have very few functional skills. And we expect them to go out onto the street and lead a productive life? No, they don't. And it's a tragedy of monumental proportion. And what's more tragic is in the world today, there are millions of families who want to adopt those very kids. Today, they want to. They're asking to. They're stepping forward. Please, can we? But they can't. We have an available and abundant solution to a huge social tragedy that on a one-on-one basis is a kid's life. And we aren't dealing with it. So that's what kept me going.
Hi, I should mention my name is Aaron Young. I'm a mining engineering student. My question, just to follow up with that, is what specifically in the process is keeping us from doing all this without maybe an 80-minute movie solution or answer?
Well, forming social and political will is necessary because there is an abundance of challenges and issues, and how do leaders and cultures and societies prioritize things? And you would think just naturally, Aaron, that children would be elevated to the top of the food chain as a natural reaction and a natural priority. But it doesn't. It hasn't been that way. Our actions are in conflict with that natural thought that these children's lives should, in fact, be a priority. So we are encouraged because this isn't a real controversial issue. A child having a right to belong in a family and defending that basic human right, I don't see much controversy behind that. What we have to let our leaders know is it matters to us. And once it matters to us, it will become a priority for them. And that's why this tour, our movement, is so critical. Because if we succeed, many more children will have what they want, which is a family. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Really appreciate your comments very much.
Thank you.
Two-part question.
Sure.
First is, because I teach political science, I've spent a little good deal of time in Washington, D.C., I'd be curious to know the name of the U.S. senator that you were speaking of. And second question is, have you had any contact with Scott Simon, NPR Saturday morning host since 1985, in which he's a strong...
Adopted, is that correct?
Pardon me?
Doesn't he have two adopted children?
He has two adopted young girls from China.
Yes.
He's written a book on adoption in which he encourages prospective parents to think adoption. Think adoption is quickly in their minds rather than say as a last resort option. And he has spoken all over the country about adoption.
Well, I will be sure. I think I do know his name. And then we have our PR firm who is helping us promote the film, I think, is aware of him. And this would be a natural forum for this conversation. Relative to the senator, I'm not going to disclose that name now because, by the way, I've had that discussion with umpteen members of Congress, and many of them have had similar reactions.
Well, the reason why I ask is because seemingly this would be the type of issue that no senator, no representative would express opposition, saying this is not a priority. This is not something we should be thinking about spending taxpayer dollars for and making it a national priority.
Well, if that was true, the film, the tour, this mm-hmm. movement wouldn't be necessary.
That's right.
Because I'm not the very first person to
That's
raise
right.
this issue.
Exactly right.
I mean, if you look at all of the people and all of these adoptive families who have been stuck, whether it's the Kyrgyzstan 65, the Guatemala 900, the families in Nepal. The list goes on and on. Who write letters? When we made the film, if you're going to come and see the film tonight, we'll show one of the families who went to five members of Congress and specifically asked for help to get their little boy out of this orphanage, which used to be an ex-prison. And they had a hard, hard time getting anybody's attention. So I agree with you in principle that none of our elected officials should not see this as a natural priority, but their actions and their behaviors, and in many cases, some of their candor really does validate why this movement has to happen, because these kids' lives do matter, and we have to get their attention. And today they're off talking about sequester, or they're talking about budget, or they're talking about gun laws. And by the way, there are a lot of pressing issues in this country and in this world, and I understand that there's a limited mind share. But these children deserve to have a place and a elevated sense of priority in their thinking. And that's why we're doing the tour.
And that's why private citizens doing what they're doing help to motivate elected officials who very often wait to see which way the parade is going before they try to jump in front of it.
Well, that's right. And I think, the encouraging part is that political systems typically don't do things proactively. They react. They already are reacting. We've had three members of Congress come to the first 25 screenings, which has been very healthy. I mean, we're an independent documentary film, you know, and but to have, you know, three members of Congress come out and talk about this film and the fact that new legislation is happening, we were able to show the film in the Congressional Theater. I think we are getting their attention, but we've got a long ways to go, and that's why this group here is the group of people who ultimately will change the world in many fronts. And that's what, I mean, the greatest thing you have going for you, your most fabulous asset, is your youth, your energy, and your can-do attitude. And you should embrace that. And that's why I hope my message today resonated with at least one of you. Because along the way, you're going to find something that you have a hard time accepting. And my message is pure and fundamental. When that day happens, don't walk away. You can deal with it, and one voice can lead to another voice and can lead to another voice, and that's how revolutions in thought and spirit occur. Yes?
Can you talk some more about the proposed legislation that's being drafted?
I can't give any details now. That would be unfair. But I can tell you that over the course of the last few years, there have been lots and lots of people and some real good beginnings of energy behind this issue and making these children's lives matter. And so that there is now a new legislative package that will be introduced. And as I understand it, and obviously, I mean, this is just based on my information, is that it's going to be introduced on May 2nd, and it will be a key first step. And that legislation really is, if it does come out on May 2nd, is introduced, or at least formally announced, is that our march, the Step Forward for Orphans March, which I'd love to have every one of you come. I think it'd be a great experience. Great time of the year to be in D.C., May 17th. It's a Friday. We're going to walk, you know, lockstep. We're going to deliver our petition to every member of Congress, to President Obama, and basically we're doing what other groups have done in the past. Enough is enough. And I can't really comment on the particulars of the legislation. But I will say, I think to set proper expectations, is that one single piece of legislation is never going to change the game. We are not going to knock this wall down with one swing of the bat. The Both Ends Burning campaign, which is I'm the founder of, will hopefully exist for 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And we'll always be pushing. We'll always be asking to challenge the current expectation. We'll always be looking for better ways, process reform and improvement to find pathways to create great senses of transparency, great safeguards, and greater efficiencies so children can join a family. You know, this is a really classic example, and you guys will get this. But this circumstance is a classic example for social entrepreneurialism. Because we've done this so long in a bureaucratic sense, and we've kind of fallen into this thinking of, well, it can't be done. Or that's just the way it is. And, you know, a social entrepreneur takes a social problem and looks for new and inventive ways. And there are plenty of ways to create efficiencies and create sensibility to this system. And the outcome is that these kids will have a family. Yes, sir.
Certainly there's a lot of barriers here in the U.S. for international adoption. But what would you say to all the barriers in international law or in the laws in the country in which the children are stuck, and how to, I don't know, break those barriers down? Because to me, those seem a lot bigger in a lot of ways.
Well, I think what you have to, that's a complicated question, but if you were able to distill it down, at the heart of the matter is determining eligibility, okay? Is the family representative of a healthy, sane, nurturing, and loving environment for the child, no criminal intent, and is the child a legitimate orphan? So ultimately, you have to be able to determine eligibility and find efficient ways to determine that. One of the bigger problems today, and you may find this shocking, is that most of this process is done manually in country. And so you have these files, these dossier files, that are stacked up 10 feet high that basically sit there for months on end just to get one stamp. And it's almost as if some of the slowdown is almost intentional. And we have this real basic understanding that every day matters in the life cycle of a child, but yet we haven't been willing to really rethink and engineer a process today that on average takes 33 months. We're comfortable accepting a process that takes 33 months. Now, if any of you have any children in this room, if you had a kid, would you feel comfortable putting your child in an environment for the first 4 years of their life where there was very little developmental stimulation, very little nutrition, very little safety, and they're basically just fending for themselves? Would you be comfortable with that? Of course you wouldn't. But yet we're comfortable with millions of children living in those circumstances just because we have a lethargic and a highly inefficient process. And I want to make things really clear, is we're not advocating, and no one is advocating for anything that's reckless or careless. In fact, the terms, if you go back to the social entrepreneurial idea, this idea of greater transparency, greater safeguards, and efficiencies are not mutually exclusive. You create a greater efficient system using modern technology to determine eligibility. Basically, you're going to create greater transparency and safeguards, so everybody wins. But there is no common technological platform. There is no utilization, and there's very seldom a sense of urgency which would be in the best interest of a child.
Okay, this concludes our forum for today. Please join me in thanking Craig.
Thank you. Now,